Hi all, I have a favor to ask. Apple updated its iOS in a way that's affecting a lot of us podcasters and frankly costing us downloads, which in turn costs us money, which is a bummer because most of us like paying our staffs and buying our family's food. But you can help and it won't cost you a thing. All you have to do is go into your settings in your podcast app and make sure new episodes of Crimes of the Centuries and all of your other favorite podcasts are set to download automatically. You do this by going to the podcast feed, clicking on the menu button, opening the settings, and making sure the automatic download option is on. This helps even if you don't listen to every episode, though I obviously would love it if you did. Again, this costs you nothing, not even space on your phone, because after you listen to an episode, you can delete it. Easy peasy. Oh, and while we're at it, visiting sponsors using our special discount links is also really helpful. You don't even have to buy anything. Although, again, it'd be great if you did. Lastly, if you love the show, leave a review. That's super helpful too. And join our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/grabbagcollab and also tell your friends and maybe your parents. I think I'm done making demands now. Enjoy the show. While none of the cases I cover are pleasant, this case is particularly rough as it deals with sexual assault, so please take care. Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. In November 1981, a 15-year-old Cincinnati girl waited for a friend to pick her up after a junior achievement meeting. The friend was a no-show, so the girl found a payphone and called her mom to swoop in and rescue her. Around 9:30 p.m., while the girl awaited her mother at the intersection of Harrison Avenue and Kling Street, a man approached and asked if she knew the precise time, which she didn't. The man walked away, and the girl returned to scanning traffic, looking for her mother's car. But the man came back, the girl said. Quote, "I felt his hand on my shoulder. I heard a click. I turned and looked down, and I saw he had cocked his gun," end quote. For some reason, the man began jabbering at length about his gun, telling her it was a .22 caliber and that he would shoot her with it if she didn't cross the street with him into a dark and grassy alley between a bank and a house where he said he would rob her. She went with him and obediently handed over the change in her purse, the equivalent of about $1, and put the bag back on her shoulder. Having cooperated with the robbery, she turned to leave. But her attacker wasn't done with her yet. He grabbed her by the front of her jacket and gruffly instructed her to sit down. Then he began removing her clothes. The girl realized what was happening and began begging him to stop. She was a virgin, she pleaded, and if he did what it was now clear he planned to do, it would hurt. Her attacker replied, quote, "Would you rather have that pain or the pain of a bullet between your eyes?" End quote. After he was done, he acted as though she had nothing more to worry about. He told her to stay where she was until he was gone. She asked if she could get dressed, and he agreed. So she began to stand up to do so, and that's when he shot her. He fired three of those .22 caliber bullets at her. One bullet hit her neck near her jawline. Another grazed her head. The third bullet missed altogether. He had clearly aimed to kill her, and luckily he failed. The screaming, bleeding girl ran to the nearby gas station and was taken to Good Samaritan Hospital to be treated. She was descriptive about her attacker. He was young-looking and square-jawed with light hair and a mustache. She would recognize him if she saw him again, she assured. And so police showed her pictures, from which she picked a 17-year-old high school boy who had never been accused of anything violent. The girl was adamant that this was the person who had attacked her. Soon, police took her to Walnut Hills High School, where that same 17-year-old passed her and the cop, oblivious to the fact that they were even there, much less there to accuse him of a vicious crime. Again, the girl was certain, and Randall Ayers was arrested on charges of rape and attempted murder. He insisted he was innocent. He offered alibi witnesses to prove it. But the girl was sure, and prosecutors based their entire case on her testimony. In 1982, Randall Ayers was convicted by a jury and sentenced to between 15 and 50 years in prison. But there was a problem. He wasn't guilty. And it would take 9 long years before anyone would accept it. Before we get started, some quick backstory. I get inspirations for Crimes of the Centuries episodes from all kinds of places. Old newspaper headlines, books I read, listener suggestions. Sometimes they're recommended to me over at our Patreon page at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where you get a whole bunch of other shows plus early and ad-free versions of this show. But the path that led me to this case spanned several years. First, a sheriff's detective that Amanda Rossman and I interviewed in 2019 for our earlier podcast, Accused, talked about this case. It had stuck with him. And for good reason, because he remembered things like this.
Just out of the clear blue, I just said to him, "What's the worst thing you ever did in your life?" And he said, "I murdered a couple women." And I don't believe you.
It was obviously intriguing at the time, but it didn't fit in the story I was covering, which involved a different case altogether. In short, I didn't have reason to delve into it at the time. Then, far more recently, I interviewed the Hamilton County prosecutor from my job at the Cincinnati Inquirer. In the course of that chat, she also mentioned the case. This time, I did have reason to delve, and so I did. Once again, most of the details of the case didn't fit with the story I was writing, but now that I know those details, I think it's a case worth sharing. So here we are. November 11 was Veterans Day in 1981, so kids like Randall Randy Ayers got the day off of school. So did the 15-year-old girl who would later be assaulted and nearly killed that night. I feel odd just calling the victim girl, but I don't know her name and wouldn't use it if I did, so let's give her a pseudonym. I'll call her Mary. Mary was the type of student who still went on off days to school activities, hence her evenings spent at a junior achievement meeting. Randy was a different kind of student, one who spent the day drinking and smoking marijuana with some buddies. I'm not passing judgment, I was more like Mary in high school, minus the parents willing to pick me up, but some of my best friends were Randy's. We all ended up A-okay in the end. Randy went to Western Hills High School, where he wasn't a top student, but he also wasn't a problematic one either. Whatever his weekend activities were, they didn't land him in much trouble, at least not according to Colin Beeler, a family friend who worked with Randy's dad and would eventually serve as one of Randy's lawyers.
He was from a blue-class working family in a lower blue-class neighborhood in Price Hill and, you know, had whatever school issues a kid might have in that stereotype, you know, but he never had any problems.
He was a quiet kid, a bit on the short side and weighing just 130 pounds. He was in his senior year of high school and planned to become a Marine afterward. The description Mary had given police didn't quite fit him to a T. She had said her assailant was taller than she was, maybe around 5'9". Randy was more like 5'6". He was actually a couple of inches shorter than Mary. But his facial features lined up with her description, as did his hair and mustache. Mary didn't have a single doubt. And she was brave to endure that kind of trauma and then choose to testify multiple times against a man you believed raped you and tried to kill you. It was admirable. It's not her fault she was wrong. The judge who heard the case would later say that he had been uncomfortable with the conviction. There had been no corroborating witnesses or physical evidence tying Ayers to the crime. They had never found evidence he owned or had access to a .22 caliber gun. There was only the word of a traumatized teenage girl. Still, prosecutors moved forward, filed the charges, and attacked Randy's alibi, a move he himself made far easier because he had lied at first about what he'd been up to that night. He had been worried about getting busted for the pot smoking he had done with friends that night, so he initially claimed he had spent the evening playing pool with those friends at their home on Quebec Road near Fairmount. Those friends even lied for him. Then, once it became clear that these allegations weren't going away just because they weren't true, the friends and Randy all came clean. Okay, so we weren't at a house playing pool. We were smoking pot and drinking booze in an abandoned car on Forbes Road. They apologized for lying, but said they were trying to keep each other out of trouble on the pot usage. Prosecutors were not forgiving of the lie. Carl Volman, one of the assistant prosecutors trying the case, said, quote, "Once somebody lies to you, a light bulb goes off in your head and you wonder if he's telling the truth or lying again," end quote. They argued both things were likely true, that Randy could have been drinking and smoking pot that night, and while under the influence, he had spotted a young girl at an intersection and attacked. In his closing, Volman told the jury, quote, "Not only has the victim lost the beautiful flower of her virginity, but she almost lost her life," end quote. Randy's lawyer at the time, R. Scott Croswell III, tried to argue the obvious, that there was no physical evidence and nothing tying Randy to a .22 caliber gun. Plus, Randy was shorter than Mary had described, and the rest of the description was pretty generic. Like, half of all young white men looked how she described at the time, he said. And anyway, if things had gone down that night the way prosecutors said, Mary should have noticed a foul odor emanating from Randy's mouth. Croswell said, quote, "She couldn't pick out the stench of alcohol and marijuana on Randy's breath because he wasn't there," end quote. The jury decided that he was, and off Randy went to prison to serve a sentence of 15 to 50 years. He was essentially forgotten after that, his name disappearing from the pages of the local newspapers for 9 long years.
This episode of Crimes of the Centuries is brought to you by Squarespace. Some cases fade from headlines, but still reshape laws and society. Whether building a site for a research project, tracking client bookings, or selling services, Squarespace keeps the essentials in one place. Choose a polished template or use Blueprint AI to create a design that fits the work. Built-in tools help manage appointments, invoices, online payments, and email campaigns. Analytics show where visitors come from and how they engage, so business decisions rely on more than guesswork. That means more time for the work that matters, whether serving clients or sharing expertise through video. A professional website can make that work easier to find. Head to squarespace.com/launch for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code LAUNCH to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Every morning for 9 years after Randy Ayers went to prison, his grandmother Zona said a prayer. She told the Cincinnati Post in 1990, quote, "I prayed, Lord, if he's not guilty, open the doors for him and let him come out of that prison. I knew he wasn't guilty," end quote. But day after day, the doors didn't open. Colin Beeler remembered the toll that took on Randy's family.
His dad, and I believe it was his grandmother, you know, they were talking about Randy's situation, which, as I understood then and today, he always flatly denied ever being involved with the crime which he was charged.
Now, I want to pause on this for a second. In my day job, I cover a lot of innocence claims, and invariably, after each story runs, I get feedback that goes something like this. Why are you saying he maintained his innocence as though that matters? It's not like someone who's guilty is going to admit they're guilty. Some actually do, as you'll hear later in this episode, but sure, plenty don't. That's not unusual. But what stands out is when a story remains consistent. Once Randy admitted he'd been smoking pot and not playing pool, his story never changed. Guilty people will often shift little details, in part because it's hard to remember the specificities of a lie, and also to make their stories seem ever more plausible as time goes on. Like, when the 1980s progressed and DNA testing started regularly happening, a guilty guy might well have shifted things to account for that. Like, okay, I said I was nowhere near the scene of the crime, but actually, I did lend my friend a code and he might have been there, so if you find my DNA at the scene, that's what's up. Randy never did that. He never changed his story. On top of that, Randy was eligible for parole within a few years of his sentence beginning. In 1984, he went before the parole board for the first time. The board wanted him to show remorse. Randy refused. A few years later, he faced the board again.
He was offered to be released on parole, but one of the he would have had to have acknowledged his responsibility, and his grandmother begged him to, even though he said, "I never did it," begged him to acknowledge his responsibility, and he just wouldn't. So he was denied parole.
Behind bars, Randy suffered. He was targeted by inmates who weren't keen on a child rapist in their midst. He later told a reporter, quote, "With the kind of charge I had, the other prisoners jump you a lot. They make you pay. If you put up with it once, you have to put up with it forever. You learn you have to be the same as everybody else. You have to turn into an animal," end quote. He learned to adapt, fighting back when he had to. He also began lifting weights, gaining 40 pounds of straight muscle. He joined the powerlifting team and was bench pressing 310 pounds, deadlifting 450. Meanwhile, the man who had actually raped and nearly killed Randy's supposed victim was free to do whatever he wanted to whomever he wanted. Peter Alderucci was a newcomer to the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office when he first encountered a guy named Robert Minton. As he told me in 2019,
"I got called in the middle of the night to go to a robbery at a gas station on North Bend Road right by I-74. The robbery had already taken place. It was two men, one white male and one younger black male, went in and robbed the store and were gone. I was processing the scene when we got the call that they picked up two suspects that fit the description in the car not far away from there."
Some evidence was found with the men as well, so they were taken to headquarters on Hamilton Avenue to be charged with robbery. Alderucci's job was to process them.
Fingerprints, photographs, you know, that what we call the head sheets, which is all the information, personal information on them.
The younger guy was Aaron Brown, an 18-year-old from Chicago. The older guy was, of course, Robert Minton. The two had robbed the bonded oil station first, and then the United Dairy Farmers. Investigators found a revolver inside the car and said the duo might have been involved in other armed robberies as well. And so they asked a lot of questions.
Robert Minton just, for some reason, he took a liking to me, started talking to me. He started admitting to some other burglaries, one burglary in Bridgetown that I had just processed the day before, so I recognized it. I said, "I can close that case." And he told me some other cases where he went into a house in Indian Hill where a high school boy was homesick, and he pretty much hogtied him and dragged him around the house while he burglarized the place.
He sounds charming, no? Well, according to Alderucci, he actually was. The two men, cop and suspect, got along. Minton seemed willing to help Alderucci close some of the robberies and burglaries he'd caught as a cop. It was easy for Minton because, you know, he'd committed those crimes. And for whatever reason, he didn't seem keen to shrug responsibility.
I just think he just wanted to go back to prison. He just couldn't make it on the outside.
Minton told Alderucci he'd just gotten out of prison in Kentucky. He'd had a few run-ins in Ohio, too. He gave Alderucci his whole backstory.
And then he told me how he used to like to torture animals when he was a little kid. And he was talking to me about this stuff as if we were talking about a baseball game, just very nonchalant, very matter-of-fact.
Alderucci said he was surprised that Minton would unload these dark secrets so willingly, especially having been read his rights and signing all the paperwork that made it very clear that anything he said could be used against him. But Alderucci didn't let that surprise show. A good interviewer wouldn't, right? You want to hear all the details, so you try not to pass judgment while the other person is spilling their guts.
Just out of the clear blue, I just said to him, "What's the worst thing you ever did in your life?" And he said, "I murdered a couple women." And I don't believe you. He said, "Yeah, I did." I said, "Well, do we have the bodies?" And he said, "One you do and one you don't."
The first was a 17-year-old named Sandy Alina Barrett, who disappeared May 23, 1990, after leaving a relative's house with the aim to walk back home. She never made it. About 12 hours after she'd last been seen, Sandy's body was found in a lot on Beekman Street. Now, sometimes innocent people claim credit for crimes they didn't commit, so Alderucci pressed for details only the killer would know, and he got some. When Sandy's body had been found, it was clear that someone had cut her panties off with a knife.
So I said, "How did you get her undressed?" And he said he had a hunting knife, and he said, "I cut her panties off."
After assaulting her, he let her go, then decided that wasn't a good idea after all. I'll spare you the audio on this because it's pretty disturbing. But in summation, he ran over Sandy twice with his car, but she was still alive, so he grabbed a hammer and crushed her skull. Those details hadn't been released to the public, so Alderucci trusted the confession. Alderucci then flipped through the mental file folder to try and figure out the other case, the one in which Minton said the body had not yet been found, and remembered that there was a woman who had disappeared from her job as a clerk at the Westwood Dairy Mart. 20-year-old Georgiana Gatto should have been working the third shift at the shop, but police discovered the store unattended about 6:10 a.m. on June 27th. By the time Alderucci talked with Minton about the case, Georgiana had been missing for 2 weeks. Minton said he set out to rob the store, found Georgiana working there alone, and forced her to load stolen food into his car. Then he pushed her into the vehicle, drove her to the woods, raped her there, and while he was raping her, took a knife and slit her throat.
And he left the body there. So we drove all over Hamlin County. We couldn't find it. And finally, we just happened to be coming up Harrison Avenue by Rybalt Road in 74. And he said, "Stop here." And we let him out of the car and he pulled the bushes back and we could see a skeleton or body, you know, down in the woods. And I checked the body and could see it on the clavicle. There was a notch or a nick and his knife fit in there perfectly. So we knew we did that.
The day after Minton led deputies to Georgiana's body, a front page headline in the Inquirer read, "Robbery suspect linked to murders." But Minton wasn't done confessing.
This episode of Crimes of the Centuries is brought to you by Squarespace. Some cases fade from headlines, but still reshape laws and society. Whether building a site for a research project, tracking client bookings, or selling services, Squarespace keeps the essentials in one place. Choose a polished template or use Blueprint AI to create a design that fits the work. Built-in tools help manage appointments, invoices, online payments, and email campaigns. Analytics show where visitors come from and how they engage, so business decisions rely on more than guesswork. That means more time for the work that matters, whether serving clients or sharing expertise through video. A professional website can make that work easier to find. Head to squarespace.com/launch for a free trial And when you're ready to launch, use offer code LAUNCH to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
For Randy Ayers, prison life was abysmal. He spent all his time working out, practicing the guitar his grandmother had gifted him behind bars, and doing his assigned work, which was to weld bed frames. His appeal attempts have failed, so did his parole efforts. By the time Robert Minton confessed to the murders of Sandy Barrett and Georgiana Gatto, Randy had been in prison 8 years, literally a third of his life. When the first stories about Robert Minton hit the papers, Randy had no reason to pay attention. Nothing in the early write-ups suggested he might have anything to do with some random rape in 1981. Once he was charged with Sandy and Georgiana's murders, police stopped asking him as many questions, but that didn't stop Minton from talking.
And later on, it turned out that he ended up admitting to another girl several years before that he had forgotten to tell me. He shot this high school girl and raped her, but she lived.
To be clear, he didn't make this confession to Alderucci. He made it to someone else who alerted prosecutors. The details Minton gave matched that of our victim Mary, and according to Alderucci, that case had never sat right with anyone but her. He said that after Randy was arrested for that assault,
the prosecutor and the police didn't think it was him, but she identified him in three different lineups and on the street, and they had to prosecute him.
Just to hammer this home, let me repeat that. He said police and prosecutors never thought Randy Ayers was guilty, but because the victim was so sure, they felt they had to prosecute him, based solely on the allegations of a traumatized 15-year-old girl. The judge said if Randy had waived his right to a jury trial, he would have acquitted him in a bench trial. No one in an authority position thought Randy was guilty at the time, but prosecutors successfully convinced 12 jurors that he was, and they convicted him. By the way, Randy had taken the stand in his own defense. He said he had never even hung out at Harrison Avenue and Kling Street. He testified, quote, "I didn't do anything," end quote. He said he'd stayed calm while being interviewed by police because, quote, "I didn't think they'd take me to court for something I didn't do. I'm scared now," end quote. The jury hesitated too, by the way. They went into deliberations on a Friday and told the judge they were deadlocked after 5 hours. They had asked permission to visit the crime scene at night, presumably to get a sense for visibility, to sort of test out whether Mary could have likely seen her attacker in any detail. But Judge Thomas Crush denied the request. Instead, he ordered them to recess for the weekend. Hours into their deliberations on Monday, they came back and again said they were deadlocked. Crush again ordered them back to the jury room to keep trying. 90 minutes later, they came out with a guilty verdict. One of Randy's sisters began sobbing and screamed, "I hate all of you."
And it turns out that it wasn't him. It was Robert Minton.
On July 19, 1990, Ayers was attending a health class at the Lebanon Correctional Institute when he learned another man confessed to the crime. The rape victim, or Mary, was brought to the Hamilton County Justice Center to look at both Ayers and Minton, but couldn't identify which was her assailant. The next day, an assistant prosecutor went back to Judge Crush and asked that Ayers be freed because he'd been wrongfully convicted. The judge did so, saying, quote, "I expressed the opinion at the time that I would not have convicted him had it been tried to me," end quote. Never mind that there's a mechanism in place for that. Randy's lawyers asked at the time that the judge dismissed the charges because of insufficient evidence, and he refused. Now, when Randy's release made headlines, the narrative was that he and Minton looked so much alike that it was understandable the victim got them confused. I agree with that. So does Alderucci.
But if you see the two, they could almost be brothers. They didn't know each other, but they looked so much alike.
And so does Colin Beeler, the family friend who would represent Randy after his exoneration.
But the features, the kind of the dirty brown, stringy hair, longer hair, you know, I mean, the similarities of the photographs between those guys, other than the height, was fairly good.
But that's why eyewitness identification is so fraught. A lot of people look like other people. Have you ever seen one of those memes comparing similar-looking actors? Jeffrey Dean Morgan and Javier Bardem, for instance. Natalie Portman and Keira Knightley. Zoe Deschanel and Katy Perry, at least when their hair is styled similarly. It's long been accepted that eyewitness identification is unreliable, at least when the victim hadn't previously known the person they were identifying, and that's the only evidence against someone. So yes, it's understandable the victim got the two men confused. What's less understandable is why police and prosecutors and even the judge pressed forward when they had reservations about her identification. It cost Randy Ayers a lot. One of his sisters, Wanda Ward, told WCPO in Cincinnati.
They took a lot of his life away. He was a teenager when they locked him up, and he missed a lot. High school, graduating, prom, driving a car, he missed all of it.
When Randy left prison, he told a reporter that the first thing he planned to do was visit his grandmother, the one who prayed daily for his release. And he wanted to sit outside and look at the night sky. Here he is talking to reporter John Matarese, who's been a Cincinnati TV personality for more than 30 years.
They just said, you're free to go.
Yeah.
After 8 years. You think you deserve more than that?
Yeah. They gave me a lot more.
In fairness, they did do more, eventually, thanks to Randy's attorney, Beeler.
His conviction was not only set aside, we went through another process and had him found to be wrongly convicted. So it was a two-step process. The first part was they set it aside, I got involved, we had him declared to be wrongly convicted, and then we filed an action in the court of claim seeking compensation.
Randy was awarded $365,000 for his wrongful conviction. That was a mixture of the $25,000 per year Ohio offered exonerated people, plus a bit more based on his earnings potential. To calculate that, Beeler used Randy's dad's blue-collar job as a model and mapped out the salary he likely would have been earning had he followed in his dad's footsteps, which is what Randy ultimately did, at least for a spell. He worked hard, fell in love, and was father to three kids.
He never seemed to act like he was holding a grudge against anybody, at least around me and around some of the other people that we knew in common.
But he had changed. He'd always been quiet. Now he was more so. He had spent his formative years not just in prison, but in prison being treated like a rapist, having to watch his back and stay fit in case anyone jumped him. Then once he was released and news of his settlement spread, he was suddenly bombarded with people wanting a piece of his money. After working at the furniture moving company for a while, he decided he wanted to use his funds to pursue other interests. He opened a business that failed. Then he was approached by some filmmakers in California who said they wanted to make a movie about him. Beeler said all they did was take advantage of him.
They billed him for every first-class stamp they used to send him a letter.
The movie never happened, of course. When someone courts you to tell your life story, they usually pay you, not the other way around. Beeler said Randy just started drifting away. One problem led to another problem, which led to another. Now, as I'd mentioned, I was reminded of Randy's case after my recent interview with Hamilton County Prosecutor Melissa Powers, who was appointed after longtime prosecutor Joe Dieters was named a member of the Ohio Supreme Court last year. Powers this spring announced the formation of a conviction integrity unit, which is meant to review wrongful conviction claims. Powers said the office has always admitted when it charged the wrong suspect and was quick to right conviction wrongs. As for an example, she pointed to Randy's case. I didn't remember having talked with Alderucci about him 5 years ago. Mostly, I've remembered Robert Minton, the actually guilty guy. So I decided to look for Randy to see how he felt about the prosecutor's office touting his case as an example of their dedication to find the truth. It turned out I couldn't ask Randy that question because he died in October 2005. Alderucci had told me that, but I didn't realize that until I went back to use the tape for this episode. When Ayers died, there was only a bare-bones obituary, So I emailed the Hamilton County Coroner's Office on the off chance he died, A, within the county, and B, of a non-natural cause. The administrator there quickly emailed back with the cause of death. It read, quote, perforation of the brain, gunshot wound of the head, manner of death is suicide, end quote. Randy Ayers was 41 years old. He left behind three young children and a fiance. I asked his family friend turned lawyer.
I know this is impossible to truly know. You think he would be alive if he hadn't been convicted?
Yes. Based on the experiences I had with his father, with his grandmother, with his other relatives, with the social economic community in which they were part of, yeah. Because if he'd never been convicted, he would have hopefully gotten a high school diploma, would have gone out and gotten a blue-collar working job, and probably would have married, had a couple of kids, and worked and paid his bills, and went to the neighborhood bar every now and then, had a few beers. But yeah, he would have been a productive, good member of the community.
Joe Dieters, the former Hamilton County prosecutor, also acknowledged in a WCPO interview years ago that those nearly 9 years in prison probably did contribute to Randy's suicide.
To be wrongly accused like that and spend that much time, you know, basically like an animal in a zoo, I'm sure it had an effect on him.
The case against Randy Ayers went down in Hamilton County history in two ways. First, it was the only time prosecutors here acknowledge having convicted an innocent person for a crime he didn't commit. To be clear, there have been several overturned homicide cases since 2022 in this county, some involving Brady violations and questionable informant testimony, but prosecutors blame overzealous judges for those reversals. And second, prosecutors vowed to never again bring a case to court based only on eyewitness identification.
We have to have more than just a simple ID, because these things have proven to be just so untrustworthy. You're gonna get the innocent person found guilty.
Which is, obviously, more than a little oopsie. There's no fixing a mistake like this. No amount of money can make up for that time lost, and no amount of therapy can undo the trauma. As for Robert Minton, he was sentenced to life in prison and is currently housed in Ohio's London Correctional Institution. To research this story, I interviewed Peter Alderucci in June 2019 and Colin Beeler in April 2024. I also got information on the case from Hamilton County Prosecutor Melissa Powers and read and watched contemporary news coverage both at the time of Randy Ayers' conviction and his exoneration. Special thanks to Terry DeMio of The Enquirer for helping edit this episode. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced